This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Gone are the days, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid, when we can somehow imagine that the situation is not as bad as our scientists say it will be, nor that the consequences are so far off in the future that we need not worry. Like a sleepwalker, we seem unable to wake up to the fact that so many of the catastrophic consequences of carrying on with business as usual are bearing down on us faster than we think, already dragging many millions more people into poverty and dangerously weakening global food, water, and energy security for the future.
Welcome, welcome to a full helping of warnings, despair, good humor, and one man's example to the world. I'm Alex Smith. With so much audio, we must orient and load up quickly. Direct from the alternative presentations at the Rio Plus 20 conference, you will hear two short speeches on the economy that's never counted, and the assault on a new science of planetary boundaries. Independent environmental journalist Stephen Leahy sent us the exclusive audio of Kate Raworth and Johan Rockström in Rio. Then we'll journey to Australia. The self-sufficient John Morgan tells us about his 9-star energy-efficient home that needs no furnace or air conditioner. Plus, a look at Australia's new carbon tax, coming into effect July 1st. But first, a group of 21 scientists from very different fields of study produced a special briefing for the journal Nature. That was ahead of the meeting of world leaders in Rio de Janeiro for the second Earth Summit. They concluded our planetary home could be heading for a massive shift, a new state not seen for millions of years. It's spine-chilling, so I'll need to call on my radio sidekick for this program, none other than Charles, Prince of Wales.
There were basic perceptions to overcome, particularly public awareness of climate change, which was lamentable to say the least. Which is why, despite countless such meetings and gatherings ever since, the increasingly dire warnings issued by yourselves and others around the world that we are rapidly breaching one planetary boundary after another have been consistently and alarmingly ignored. At the moment, there is a dangerous, fundamental disconnection between scientists, the public, and the private sector. It is dangerous because it blocks so much progress on the ground, partly due to the fact that too few people believe, or are discouraged from believing, what the best of our science is telling us, and partly because they do not relate that troubling global picture to their own isolated situation and behaviour. Which is why I cannot stress enough that any action from now on must have as its ultimate aim the goal of integrated thinking. Not only do we need to connect each individual's concern with that of the Earth's, we also need to forge an economic framework that is just as joined up. We can ill afford any more to let things operate in separate silos within individual disciplines. Thinking must be integrated, just as policies must be integrated.
That is from Prince Charles as he addressed the Rio leaders by video link on June 19, 2012. Charles demanded scientists and other experts come out of their silos to assess what is really happening in the world. That is exactly what did occur when a group of scientists were organized by the Berkeley campus of the University of California. We go now to one of the participants, Arna Moores of Simon Fraser University. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm here with Arna Moores, and we're going to be talking about one of the more shocking, I think, papers to come out in some time. It's talking about the possible catastrophic impacts that could happen if we just continue on our way with climate change and other ecological impacts. So we are pleased to have one of the 21 co-authors, I believe it is, Arna Moores, and he's from Simon Fraser University. And I'm just going to ask you first to explain, if you will, the broad general context of what this paper is about.
Sure. Thanks for having me. So the context, one context is the Rio Plus 20 Summit, which is ongoing. And in preparation for that, a group of researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, decided to hold a meeting where they invited people from all sorts of different disciplines in biology to cogitate on sort of interaction connections between climate change and biodiversity specifically. And this group invited mostly theoreticians, so it's more conceptual people, to see if there was anything that would bubble up that had been overlooked or was being overlooked or required some more focused attention. And this review, which you refer to, which is called Approaching a State Shift in Earth's Biosphere, came out last week in the journal Nature, and that's what we're talking about today.
All right. Now, a shift. What sort of a shift are we talking about?
Yeah, so what is a state shift? So one way of thinking about it is that you can project into the future, and you can do sort of straight line projection and say, okay, well, this is happening, and there's a small change here, and there's a small change here, and we're going to be able to predict what's going to happen by adding up a bunch of small changes. A state shift is where, if you're kind of graphically minded, you can think of it as where the line stops being straight and does a huge jump up or jump down or jump somewhere else, and you move into a completely different regime. And the different regime we're talking about is a different global regime, so that the way that the ecosystems are organized now will completely change and you'll get new organization. That's one way of thinking of a state shift.
And you had to employ some really different methods to come up with this. I mean, can you describe some of the different fields that were drawn together for this project?
Yeah, so yeah, when you say different methods, I mean, this is a sort of a review by induction, I think if I have that term right, where we were looking at examples from lots of different fields and asking whether we could draw some generalities from those examples from those different fields. So we had mathematicians who model toy ecosystems and then perturb them and see if they undergo state shifts. We had ecologists that look at food webs and then model those food webs and then say, okay, well, what happens if this, you know, we have this species go extinct? Well, how does the food web react? Is it stable or does it completely fall apart and do new food webs result? We had a lot of paleontologists who had been studying how the Earth has changed in the past, and they've actually seen global state shifts. And we had evolutionary biologists, people who are geneticists, all coming together to have a look at how climate change and biodiversity are connected. And we came up with some, I don't want to say they're surprising, all of the independent patterns that we talk about have been documented many times and by people who are much more expert than the people that were there. But we tried to ask whether we should think of them together, if we consider them all at once, do we get something different? So when you say different methods, I think it's different patterns at different scales. We're all collected together, and then it was really just, we're just making a plausibility argument. We're saying this is, you know, something at the global scale could happen because of the things that we're doing, because of the things that we see in other contexts, at other times, at other scales.
So we're not just talking about climate change here. We're talking about things like where we just take over the land that former species were there, or we wipe out mangrove swamps, or all those things are included?
Right. So that's one of the major issues. So we have this overriding climate change, which is occurring incredibly rapidly. And then you layer on top of that some of the other things that humans are doing. So one is the extinction of a lot of biodiversity and the particular parts, you know, top predators, for instance. We have land conversion, so we're now have converted to use for us over 40% of the entire Earth's surface. That's cities, agricultural land, you know, mining, dams, infrastructure. And we've also pulled a lot of the total amount of energy that the Earth takes from the sun and turns into food. We've actually sequestered for ourselves, so somewhere between 20 and 40% of the entire net primary productivity is actually being used by us. That's one species. And all three of those things that we are doing on a global scale are the sorts of things that can cause state shifts in ecosystems at smaller scales and at other times.
Well, you know, you talk about species extinction, and I've been hearing some terrible statistics about that. It seems to get worse as time goes on. And yet, when I talk to people in the public, it's like, well, okay, we're missing a few snails or a beetle somewhere or a couple of flowers. What difference is that going to make? So how did the extinction process work into this paper?
Well, that's a good question. I think, to be fair, in this paper, we simply bring it up as one of these pressures, one of these things that's happening on the global scale, and it's something that we have to think hard about. We do know, so the interesting, maybe one interesting factoid is that the paper just after ours in the same issue of the journal Nature from last week is entitled Biodiversity Loss and Its Impact on Humanity. And there they go into some detail how the loss of species both locally and globally can have severe impacts on ecosystem services and ecosystem function. So we just refer to that, to all that other work, and say we know that when species go extinct, big changes can happen. And I can give you one example where it's not just a few snails or a few flowers, but if you look at the cod fishery on the east coast of North America, particularly the east coast of Canada, there's a case where we overfished the cod, so pulled out a top predator from the ecosystem. And even after we stopped and thought that, okay, the cod will come back, they didn't come back, and the whole ecosystem has changed. So that's a state shift that's occurred regionally in that fishery that was caused by the loss of a particular species. And there are lots of other examples of that.
Well, it seems to me, too, that timing is everything. I've spoke to some paleoclimatologists, and we've talked about these changes in deep time. They're sort of fuzzy timescales. Was it over 100,000 years, or was it over 10 million years? It seems to take a long time in many of those cases. Now we're talking about something that happens very quickly because of us. And does your paper contain some indications about the timescales that we're looking at, how quickly things could happen?
Yes, we do discuss that at least a wee bit. So a couple of interesting points that we bring up in the review include the fact that the last global state change, which was the shift from the glacial to the interglacial that happened somewhere on the order of 10, 11,000 years ago, the more we study that particular state change, which was dramatic, of course, because we went from being underneath kilometers of ice to being able to grow banana trees here, up here in Vancouver at least, that could have occurred very, very quickly, on the order of maybe even 1,000 years where most of the change took place. So we do have examples where global state changes can occur very rapidly. And then layered on that, we have the observation that the rate of climate change now is faster than the rate of climate change has been globally for a very, very long time. And when I mean very, very, we may have to go all the way back to the end Cretaceous, so the asteroid hitting the dinosaurs, where we can pick up a rate of change of global climate that's as fast as now. It's been warmer before, of course, we're actually in a fairly cool period, but we're talking about the change from year to year in temperature. So both of those things suggest to us that these sorts of state changes can occur over short periods of time, because they have. And we may be pushing the system even more than it's been pushed in the past. I mean, remember, this is just speculation. We have we hope we're wrong, and we have absolutely no idea whether a global state change is even possible. Well, certainly possible, but whether it's probable. But we have no idea when it would start and how long it would take.
All right. So then what is really the purpose of doing this project and of doing this paper? And I want to try and get in this word catastrophe. There is a whole viewpoint of science, of catastrophism, that it actually is a valid science. It's not just something that the radio people whip up or newspapers. Sometimes very strange things happen in nature fairly quickly. So were you trying to measure out whether that is possible, and would you use a word like that?
So I would say that the people that came and wrote this paper would not be not all of those people would be the ones that you would ask about something as specific as that. I think the point of doing this was to raise awareness and focus people's attention on the possibility. So instead of just doing a straight line extrapolation, we feel that people who are studying land use change and energy movement through ecosystems, extinction, climatologists should get together and see whether it's possible to make some quantitative predictions. And because it's a state change, because it's one of these things where everything goes topsy-turvy and you move into a new state, prediction is, of course, very, very difficult. But what we do know, or I shouldn't say we know, but what we're fairly confident in saying is that if the Earth was to go through a state change it would be very disruptive. Because the last 10,000 years have been some of the most benign, predictable years in Earth's history. And that's not a coincidence. The reason that we've been able to develop as a species, socially and technologically and all the rest, is in large part due to this predictable, benign climate in which we've found ourselves. So you can build a city and know that it's going to be there 100 years into the future. So I think it's about focusing people's attention and saying, look, this might not be true, but we should find out. And so I don't think any of the people who came to this meeting were catastrophists. So we certainly went into the meeting open-minded. This came out of the meeting. It wasn't going into the meeting. People, we discussed all sorts of things we thought might be important. And this just seemed to be the one that we thought required attention now. Because if it's right, it's a big deal.
Well, yes. And I think one of the important points that you've raised, and the example of the cod contains it, is this idea of a state shift that you're not going to go back. I think that a lot of the public, and myself included, have thought, well, all right, we'll bring the CO2 somehow down to 350 again. Things will go back to the way they were. We'll all return to the way. But no, some states, you just never can go back.
That's actually one of the things that I hadn't realized either until I got into this, is that it's called hysteresis. It's a technical term, but it's exactly that. As soon as you start getting drawn to this new state, you cannot go back. Even if you remove, if you try to put everything back the way it was, it's too late. The system is just flipping over and becoming something else. And I think you're right. That's one of the things that, again, if we can make that clear to people, then it might lead to some more focused attention. I mean, I say that with lots of caveats, because what scientists say and what scientists know often has very little to do with what happens in the world. one can only hope.
I know. And, the Rio Plus 20, I've already had emails from various people saying that the back text is more or less finished, that the politicians are going to make their speeches, but it's just another paper or another large report, and we have so little action on it. So I'm wondering, do you see a future life for the work and the project that you've just done? Is it going to continue, or will the paper itself, do you think, get further out there and start people doing new work?
That's a very good question. I wish I knew. I think it will lead to new scientific work. I think that this kind of collaboration, where you have all these people who've never been in a room together, I don't expect people who study populations and study fossils and study plants and do math. And I hope that that there'll be other collaborations that may be even more focused on this topic. I mean, one of the major questions that we leave open is whether it's predictable. So are there telltale signs of a state shift? So there are sometimes in simple computer modeling and things, but can that get scaled up? Can we take climate data and can we analyze it in a new way where we might pick up some telltale signs that it is possible? Beyond that, as I just said, we've known about global warming since the 80s. The scientific community has known about it. And as you say, we've got Rio Plus 20, which is, I've heard the same as you, that it's just going to be another piece of paper.
Do you have any suggestions for people to follow up on this? Are there websites that you would recommend, or is it basically going to the publication Nature and getting it if you have a subscription? Or how can listeners follow up if they want to?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have posted a version of the paper on my website, because obviously not very many people have subscriptions to Nature, and some of the other authors have done the same. I think that's a place to start. I mean, it is scientific review, so it is full of jargon. There's three or four papers in this issue, which is a Rio issue. It's called Second Chance for the Planet. There's three or four of them, and they're all very good. One's about population, one's about biodiversity, this review about climate change and state shifts. And that would give you definitely the sort of latest consensus on some of these issues. Beyond that, I wish I could direct people to places on the web that might have more useful information. That might be one of the things that would come out of this, would be places where people can go. So this just came out last week, and I think we're still sort of digesting how the public is responding, and I think there'll be some follow-up amongst the authors as to what we do next.
Well, Arne, I want to ask you to give us your website, if you would, and also send it to me an email, and I'll post it in my blog at ecoshock.info in case the address is long. But can you give us your website?
Well, the easiest is just to Google my name, Arno Morris, and you'll go directly to my website. But it's www.sfu.ca/A Morris.
Right.
Okay. I don't know, because I just Google myself and click on my lab site.
Okay, so that's A-R-N-E,
that's right?
M-O-E-R-S?
No, M-O-O-E-R-S.
Okay.
And if you just click through publications.
All right, so do that, folks, because this is one of the more surprising papers that I've run into in some time. And I will put links to Arna's website and to a Simon Fraser University press release about this that has some good facts and figures that sort of lead you into it. And then pick up a copy of Nature if you can, because there are some good things in it. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Before we hear two short speeches from the Rio Plus 20 conference, here is another brief clip from Charles, Prince of Wales.
Now, I have watched in despair at how slow progress has sometimes been, and how the outright sceptical reluctance by some to engage with the critical issues of our day have often slowed that progress to a standstill. In this, I am forcibly reminded of Sir Winston Churchill's words of warning as the threat of a cataclysmic Second World War was being studiously ignored during the 1930s. He spoke against continuing with the strange paradoxes of being decided only to be undecided, resolved to be irresolute, adamant for drift.
In the campaign to stop or at least limit climate change, what about the economy? Why is Europe skirting collapse? What about the U.S.? Why are billions of people starving while the rich people dine sumptuously on the consumer buffet? Here is 8 minutes from Kate Raworth of Oxfam explaining her growing donut campaign at the Rio Plus 20 side conference. We tune in just as she warms up.
We need is in the shape of a donut. And I apologize for bringing junk food into the room, but sometimes you need to get a little bit silly to make everybody wake up and say, what are you talking about with a donut? So I'm going to tell you about the donut. But first I'm going to start 20 years ago, not in Rio 92. I wasn't in Rio 92. I was very busy studying economics at university. And the problem with economics is quite a serious one, because anybody who studies macroeconomics, even just a little bit, will very quickly come into this diagram. It's the diagram of the circular flow of money and goods. And what you see going on is households provide their labor to firms who pay them back money. And with that money, they buy stuff and they get the goods. So the black arrows show the flow of goods and resources, and the red arrows show the flow of money. This is an incredibly simple diagram, but it is at the heart of every macroeconomics textbook. And the big thing about it is it goes right here into the back of the head of everybody who studies economics. So anybody who's a policymaker today working on economics, this went into their head quite a long time ago. And it goes in so subtly that you don't even know it's there. And the problem with it is, it's completely wrong. I'm going to tell you about three things that are completely wrong with this picture. The first one is, the economy is not floating on a white page in the middle of nowhere, because it's only looking at, this economy is only looking at monetized resources, right? It's only looking at the flow of resources that get monetized. There's a lot of other resources that really matter to human life that aren't monetized. And the first one that we're all here talking about is the environment. The economy is not floating, it's based in the environment. And there's a flow of natural resources coming into households and pollutants coming out, and same with firms. And we ignore that at our own peril. If you say that to an economics professor, they say, oh, environmental externalities. You can go and do a special paper on that. It's not a special paper, and it's not an externality. It's the fundamental resource on which we depend. So we have to bring it right into the heart of economics, and that's what ACIM is trying to do. The second thing that's missing is the unpaid care economy. The extraordinary work that's performed by parents and carers, usually women, providing care for children, looking after sick people. But also, this woman has a bucket on her head, because across the world, millions of women spend futile hours of their day carrying water to and from their houses, carrying firewood, growing food that is completely outside the monetized economy. And yet they are providing the fundamental goods and services that keep their families alive day to day. They're massively subsidizing the industrial economy by providing all these things and preparing the workers of next generation. It's completely unaccounted for. If you talk about that, your economics professor will say, ooh, that's feminist economics. That's really strange. We don't have a paper in that yet. But if you ignore this, you are completely ignoring the incredible work of half of the world's population in developing countries. You're ignoring the work of every single person in this room who gets a child up in the morning, looks after them, raises them, gets them to school, and is producing the human capital of the next generation. So we have to bring the unpaid care economy into our understanding of economics. And the third thing that's missing from this diagram is that when firms give payments to households, some people get the wages and they're quite low, and some other people get the dividends and they've been rather high recently. And the Occupy movement worldwide has pointed out that the inequality that this is resulting in matters, that societies don't want to be extraordinarily unequal. We have to pay attention to, if an economy is growing, how it's growing. If you take all of this away and go back to that picture, it's suddenly incredibly impoverished. And yet that is the picture that economists are putting into their heads. I got really frustrated with economics because of this. And that's why a couple of years ago, I was very, very excited when I saw this. Because to me, this diagram of nine planetary boundaries done by Johan and his colleagues, what I saw was where economists have refused to put the environment around the economy, the natural scientists have stepped in and done it for you. And they've had a go at quantifying it. So the green area in the middle is the safe operating space on all of those nine boundaries that we should stay within. And if you take that safer operating space, that might be safe in terms of an environmental ceiling, but we need to bring the story of poverty and human rights in here. So just as there's an environmental ceiling, so too there is a social foundation below which no human should live. Nobody should be in that blue area, because in that blue area, people don't have the resources they need to meet their rights to food, water, energy, incomes. They're living in inequality, ill health. We all have the right to the resources we need in life to meet those rights, but collectively, all 7 billion of us must do it within planetary boundaries. Surely this is the compass that should be guiding us in the 21st century. And it's shaped like a donut. And inclusive and sustainable economic development can only call itself that if it is indeed bringing us into this space. Just as Johan tried to plot where are we on the planetary boundaries, I decided to do the reverse on the social boundaries. And for all the metrics that I could find, for all the dimensions for which I could find data, we are under the boundary. So 13% of people in the world don't have enough food to eat. 19% of people live without access to electricity. 21% of people are living on less than $1.25 a day. Humanity is falling far below the boundary. And when you put the social floor next to the planetary boundaries, this is the crisis we face. Millions of people still live below the social foundation, and we've already gone over the planetary boundaries. It's a sign of just how extraordinarily unequal this world is and how unequal the path of development we've been taking has taken us on this journey.
You have been listening to green economist and Oxfam activist Kate Raworth speaking at the Rio Plus 20 conference. When Radio EcoShock returns, Kate outlines her campaign to change economics. Then we'll hear a key scientist in the planetary boundaries controversy, plus energy-independent living off-grid in Australia. Stay tuned.